This is Mayo Clinic Radio, the only show that gives you the chance to ask your questions to Mayo Clinic experts. We'll take you beyond the headlines to explain what developments in medicine mean to you. Join the conversation by phone, Twitter, Facebook, or radio.mayoclinic.org. Now, with this week's program, here are your hosts, Dr. Tom Shives and Tracy McRae.
From the Mayo Clinic, Rochester, Minnesota campus, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Welcome, everyone, to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Well, Tracy, as you know, there are some weeks where we have topics that are sort of fun to talk about, enjoyable topics. We always have enjoyable guests, but sometimes the topics are a little bit more fun to talk about than other weeks. And this week's topic, although difficult to talk about, is an important one.
Absolutely.
Suicide. Suicide, in fact, is a major, but you must say, an often preventable health problem that has probably never gotten the attention that it deserves. And I don't know whether you saw the recent report from the World Health Organization that was a little bit sobering.
Mm-hmm.
It said that every 40 seconds, somewhere in the world, someone commits suicide. And obviously, a fair number of those suicides are right here in the United States. But you add those up, and it comes to about 800,000 people who commit suicide around the world every year, almost a million people. And suicide now accounts for more than half of the 1.5 million violent deaths that occur in our world every year. Counts for more than half of them, more than wars and everything else.
Absolutely.
And wars and accidents.
Yeah, it's absolutely an important topic. And today on Mayo Clinic Radio, we'll talk with psychiatrist and suicide expert Dr. Maren Veldick. We'll discuss why suicide is difficult for most of us to talk about, and we'll find out what you should do if you feel like life isn't worth living, and how you should ask someone that you think might be suicidal. And we'll also find out if suicide is becoming more common and why. But first, last year, the Food and Drug Administration issued the final word that defined what made a food gluten-free.
Well, you know, it doesn't seem like that should be that complicated. It's got gluten in it or it doesn't.
Yeah, this is cut and dry, right? Manufacturers had 1 year to bring their labels into compliance. And as of August 5th, any food with a gluten-free label had to meet those FDA requirements. Joining us now to discuss why this is so important is Mayo Clinic gastroenterologist Dr. Joseph Murray. Good morning once again, Dr. Murray.
Good morning, Tracy.
Well, first of all, tell us, what is gluten?
Well, gluten, of course, is the protein that's contained within certain grains, wheat, barley, and rye. Now, of course, gluten is used, and those grains are used as a lot of ingredients in many, many foods. So we are very much a gluten-filled society, let's say.
And I know in the past when you've been in here, you have said you're concerned that gluten and gluten-free is almost being used as a marketing tool by manufacturers.
Yes, there's a tremendous fashion driven somewhat by popular media that gluten may be harmful, for example, and there's a big market now and a big business in what's gluten-free. And that's why these labeling laws, which have just come online and come into effect this year, make such a difference, I think, to patients who must be gluten-free.
And the people who must be gluten-free are those who have celiac disease, correct?
Yes. So celiac disease is an immune disorder triggered by gluten, and patients with it must remain off all gluten for life.
But there are not many people who truly have celiac disease, correct?
It's probably about 1 in 100, so 1% of the population. Now, many of those have not been diagnosed. Now, that's far more common than it was 20 or 30 years ago. In addition to those, there are also people who are gluten intolerant, who may not have full-blown celiac disease, but who still feel benefit by reducing or avoiding gluten.
And how do you know that? I mean, how could you self-test? How could you do a self-test?
Well, I think before one would self-test, if you've got symptoms, talk to your doctor about getting tested for celiac disease first, because those tests don't work well if you've already been on a gluten-free diet. But let's say you've done that, and you're concerned, maybe I could try and cut down gluten, see if it makes a difference. And I tell people, if they're going to do that, go gluten-free for a month and see if it makes a big difference to their health. And if it does, then maybe there's benefit to be derived from continuing it.
So when you say difference in their health, what differences would they notice?
Well, a lot of people will describe improvements of energy, maybe less bloating and gaseousness, perhaps less diarrhea if that's something they're prone to. But as I said, it's very important. If somebody has significant symptoms, they need to talk to their doctor about it before they make any changes in their diet.
Because that that can skew the results of the test if they start their gluten-free diet beforehand.
Exactly, exactly.
Okay. Now, the test for celiac disease, it's a blood test.
Yes.
Straightforward, either you have it or you don't.
It's a pretty accurate test, as long as you haven't removed gluten already.
All right, okay. Now tell us, how is a food determined to be gluten-free?
Well, the official definition now, as agreed by the FDA and internationally, is there must be less than 20 parts per million in the food. Now, some food, like a banana that's still in its skin, we can look at it and say that's inherently gluten-free, or bottled water is inherently gluten-free. But processed foods that are packaged and labeled, if they're going to have a label that says gluten-free or no gluten, it must have less than 20 parts per million. Anything above that threshold would not meet the regulations.
One of the things I thought of you recently, I was reading an article about oatmeal, and it said, it depends on the brand of oatmeal that you use if it's gluten-free or not. So then that must have something to do with the processing of that product,
indeed.
Right?
And so there can be contamination of oatmeal, because contamination in the field, if crop rotation includes barley or rye along with the oats, there can be contamination in the field and processing and milling and packaging. Mm. Any of those levels are So there's gluten-free oats, and then there's regular oats, which often are contaminated with wheat.
If you have celiac disease, obviously this is something that you were born with. When does it usually show up? When are most people diagnosed with celiac disease?
Well, the average age of diagnosis now in the U.S. is about 45 years of age. So even though the people have been eating gluten most of their lives, they may not have developed celiac disease till later. So it can literally come on any time after gluten has been introduced up until advanced old age.
Do you look forward to the time when gluten and gluten-free is not trendy? Do you know what I'm asking by that? I mean, at restaurants, you see signs like, we've got gluten-free products, and we've got, and you know, it's a big deal. It's all over the front of, I was walking through the store, and, oh, I've got gluten-free granola here for you to try. And so it seems to be kind of the buzzword and trendy, and I know you've talked about that in the past.
It is very trendy, and while I have to say that patients with celiac disease have probably benefited from that trend, and now that if someone says something is gluten-free and they package it and label it as such, then they know it is gluten-free, or it has to be.
Sure.
And so that's great for celiac patients. I'm not sure that we need to throw out gluten and bread and wheat, etc. It's a staple of a huge proportion of the world's population. And it's not inherently bad for the great majority of people. So as a scientist, I kind of recall from labeling something as being bad just because it may be bad for a small proportion of the population.
Gotcha. Now, you have a new book out. Is it out now, or is it on its way out?
It's coming out shortly. Will be Mayo Clinic on Going Gluten-Free.
Oh, my goodness.
Perfect.
We're going to have you back in again.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, bring some copies. Our listeners always like to get a nice gift from us. Hey, thanks so much, Dr. Joseph Murray.
Thank you.
All right, time for a short break. Coming up, we'll talk with psychiatrist and suicide expert Dr. Maren Veldick. Plus, myth or matter of fact, the suicide of a celebrity leads to an increase in copycat suicides. Myth or matter of fact, we'll get the answer coming up.
And right after the news at the bottom of the hour, we'll take your comments and questions for our guest, 507-282-1234. Or remember, you can tweet us at any time, hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio. We'll be back right after this.
Welcome back, Mayo Clinic Radio. Dr. Tom Shives, along with Tracy McRae, and this week's guest, psychiatrist and suicide specialist expert, Dr. Maren Veldick. Dr. Veldick, welcome to the program. Nice to have you.
Thank you for having me here.
You know, tell us a little bit about your background, because I can tell you did not grow up in Iowa.
No, I did not. I was born and raised in Croatia. I started to work as a psychiatrist there, and then I spent about 7 years as a psychiatric researcher working on the molecular biology of bipolar disorder and schizophrenia in Chicago. And then for the last 6 years, I'm back in the clinical practice here in Rochester.
So the research in Chicago, where were you in Chicago?
I worked with in the Dr. Costa's laboratory at the University of Illinois at Chicago.
Wow, interesting. And then you decided to go back into the practice of psychiatry and ended up here.
That is correct.
Great to have you.
And here at Mayo, are you still doing some research as well? I know that's part of the benefit of Mayo Clinic.
Yes, my work is split 50% in research and 50% in clinical work.
What are you researching right now?
Bipolar disorder.
And so why are you interested in that?
Well, the bipolar disorder is one of the most impactful psychiatric disorders, mm-hmm. and my research was focusing on epigenetics, meaning how the environmental influences can affect the genes. Mm-hmm.
So bipolar means people are manic and then they're depressive and then they're manic again and they go back and forth. That's where the term comes from, bipolar.
That is correct. And they also have one of the higher suicide risk. In general, mood disorders would be depression and bipolar disorder mainly. They are at the higher risk of suicide.
Which is what brings you here with us today to talk about suicide. And this, in fact, is only the second program that we have ever done on suicide in all of the years that Dr. Shives has been doing this program. Do you feel like suicide is becoming something that people can talk about more easily now? It's definitely not probably comfortable, but it seems like it's being talked about more.
That is something that I observed, and I think over the years, overall comfort of people to talk about suicide increased, which is a good thing, because one of the things that we could do to prevent suicide is to help find people who have depression and treat the depression, because depression is one of the main reasons behind people attempting or completing suicides. And the more we talk about it, the more likely that people will receive some help.
Would you say that the majority of people who commit suicide are suffering from depression?
Yes, majority of people. There are some other reasons, but depression is the main reason. Some people who are very impulsive and have certain personality disorders, they may not plan suicide in advance, but it can happen to them in a matter of seconds because of their impulsivity. So that would be another reason. In some other countries, not as much in the United States and Western countries, but more in some countries like Japan, there are also cultural reasons to commit suicide.
Oh. You know, it's interesting that you do say that it is becoming a more common topic and more acceptable to talk about, but I suspect at a cocktail party, nobody comes up to you and says, hey, let's talk about suicide. We're not there yet. I mean, there's interest in it, but it's still a bit taboo, isn't it?
It is. It is because people don't know how to talk about
right.
it. And one of the main concerns that people have, can they put thoughts about suicide in somebody's head just because they talk about it?
And mm-hmm. Should that be a concern?
That shouldn't be a concern. We know in our psychiatric practice that we should ask about whether a person has suicidal thoughts and that would not put those thoughts in their heads.
Which I think can lead us right to our myth or matter of fact of the day, and that is the suicide of a celebrity leads to an increase in copycat suicides. So does someone famous committing suicide lead to more suicides?
This is one of those questions that don't have a straightforward answer, mm-hmm. but I will
yes
try.
Yes and no. We always like those ones.
I will try. I would like to do some
right.
introduction before I say yes
All
or
right.
no. I think that the things have changed over the years. And for example, we know when Marilyn Monroe completed her suicide, there was documented increase in suicides following that.
But among both men and women?
It was mostly with the women and with the similar methods.
On that age group.
Yes,
yeah, right.
Yes. And the way how media was covering that was almost giving like a positive attention, a sense of mm-hmm. fame to it.
Mm-hmm.
But over the years, the media coverage has changed in a way that portrays suicide as a tragic event. And there are some documented examples of this was not exactly the celebrity suicide, but documented examples of importance of media coverage. There was a famous situation in Vienna, Austria, in 1987 with the suicides in the subway system. And after the leaders in the media agreed to introduce a silence, the rate of suicide dropped by 80%.
80%.
80%. One other group of people that are prone to developing copycat suicide behaviors are, unfortunately, are teenagers. But this is more within the local communities. So we see that trend.
Because they see it as the first teenager that committed suicide got some attention.
That is
correct?
That is correct.
Okay.
And so it's really important the way how attention is given. So the public stays informed, and that the ways of how help can be received is communicated without glorifying these tragic events.
I was interested what you were going to say about that, because when Robin Williams killed himself last month, I had heard that there was more calls to helplines. So there was actually some positive that came out of that unfortunate situation.
I agree. I think the media coverage over time evolved in a way that that is helpful.
All right. Myth or matter of fact, most suicide attempts fail.
That is correct. That is not that is correct. Most suicide attempts fail. There's many more attempts than completed suicide.
And what is the most common way people try to commit suicide?
The most common way of trying to commit suicide is by a medication overdose. And then the most common ways of completing suicide is it varies from country to country. It would be gunshot wounds if the guns are easily mm-hmm. accessible, or in some countries it would be ingestion with the dangerous pesticides or some things like that.
Yeah, when we were in the newsroom talking about the getting ready for the program, you said something I'd never heard before about overdose. That one of the ways, you know, if it comes to guns, to temporarily remove the gun from the home. But when it comes to medications, there's a simple way to help limit the risk of overdose. Explain that.
Yes. So the secret ingredient in restricting the means is that a person doesn't have quick, easy access to a lethal mean for a suicide. So if we put medications in a blister packages one by one, instead of putting them in bottles where they can just easily take a large quantities of medications, that in itself, there is some studies showing that would reduce the suicide.
Because it takes time.
Yes.
You have to think about it as you would push all of those all of those pills out.
Yes.
That's clever.
Most suicides are not impulsive, are they? I mean, people who commit suicide have been thinking about it for a while, right?
Yes, and the people who do complete suicide, they tend to be those who, in the numbers, who planned it in advance and organized. Mm-hmm. But there is still significant number of people who just act in the matter of minutes, and those are people who have this personality characteristic.
Sure.
of just
impulsivity.
Kind of impulsivity, being quickly reacting to things.
And do illegal drugs have anything to do with that impulsivity? Is there a link there?
Yes, there is a very strong link between suicide and illegal drugs, and we know for people who have, for example, depression, and also have at the same time drug or excessive alcohol use, then their suicide risk would just skyrocket.
Mm. All right, what are the symptoms? What are the tip-offs to you or a parent or a loved one that someone might be thinking about suicide? What observations can parents or you make about someone?
So the most common reason behind suicide is that somebody is having depression. So if we would notice that somebody is sad or withdrawn or just isolating themselves and are not treated for depression, that would be a good reason to approach them and ask, hey, what is going on? And the best way to prevent suicide is really to find depression and then treat depression, because that's where the most of the suicides are coming from. If somebody expresses a suicidal thoughts, then that person, the best thing to do is that he is brought to medical attention and to meet with somebody who is an expert and then take it from there.
Do you think that all of the research that you've done on manic depression and maybe other psychiatric abnormalities, do you think that at some point in time we're going to actually figure out what the underlying problem is? Is it a chemical problem or a lack of a chemical that leads to depression that then leads to suicide?
Yes, I strongly believe that behind a big portion of suicides, there is a genetic reason or epigenetic reason. They've done some so-called adoption studies where they would the scientists would follow the siblings or relatives who were adopted in a different families, and they would have a similar risks for a suicide.
So because they have the same genes,
yes,
even though a different environment.
Yes.
But nature
still,
versus nurture.
still, influence of environment is very strong.
All right, you're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio. Our guest psychiatrist and suicide expert, Dr. Maren Veldick, Mayo Clinic, Rochester, Minnesota.
Coming up this week's Health and Medical News with Vivian Williams. Plus, we'll take your phone calls for Dr. Veldick at 507-282-1234, or you can tweet us with your questions at hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio. This is Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Hi, I'm Vivian Williams with headlines from the Mayo Clinic News Network. The Ebola epidemic in Africa is a relatively new disease that can make one worry about widespread epidemics. But ancient pathogens, such as the bubonic plague, continued to give researchers insight into how the body reacts to infections. Now, this is according to a study from Duke University published in the journal Immunology. Their research shows how the plague bacteria hitchhike on immune cells and ride into the lungs and bloodstream where it can spread. This new info could pave the way for the development of new treatments that block the ability for the bacteria to attach to the immune cells. Now that's good news, as this ability to attach to a host cell can lead to antibiotic resistance. They say this emphasizes the importance of learning how dangerous bugs spread so they can be prepared with new strategies for treatment. And in other news, the liver transplant team at Mayo Clinic in Florida has found, based on 12 years of experience, that more than half of patients receiving a new liver can be fast-tracked to return to a surgical ward room following their transplant, bypassing a 1 or 2 day stay in the intensive care unit. The physicians and researchers have turned their knowledge of who can be safely fast-tracked into a scoring system that other transplant centers can also use, thus sparing patients potentially overly aggressive treatment and saving substantial healthcare dollars. Here's Dr. C. Burson Tanner.
Bypassing the intensive care unit, you're essentially not exposing your patients to the intensive care unit environment with the resistant bugs, avoiding the ventilator. And also, intensive care unit is very costly. Every time you step into the intensive care unit, that you spend a lot of resources, not just for your patients, also there's a halo effect for the other services that uses the intensive care unit. So this has very strong implications of resource utilization.
And this was published in the American Journal of Transplantation. And here's one more reason to get off the couch and start moving. Researchers from the University of Pennsylvania found exercise may help cancer patients going through chemotherapy. After studying mice, they found combining exercise with chemotherapy seemed to shrink tumors more than chemotherapy alone. They say exercise has been recommended to cancer patients for both its physical and psychological benefits. And in this research, they looked at how it impacts cardiac cardiac-related side effects of a common cancer drug. They found exercise didn't hurt or help the heart, but they say they were amazed at how it impacted tumor growth in that exercise plus chemo was associated with smaller tumors. They think that one explanation could be that exercise increases blood flow so more medication can get to the tumor. They say more research is needed to figure it all out. And that's a look at headlines from the Mayo Clinic News Network. I'm Vivian
You're
Williams.
Listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Welcome back. Information you want from specialists who know on air, online, and on iHeartRadio. By the way, you can listen live to this program by going to our flagship station's website at krocam.com and click listen live. Time for you to join our conversation. You can contact us by telephone at 507-282-1234. If you have a comment or question about suicide, we'd love to hear from you. Lines are open, 507-282-1234. Or there's another way to get a hold of us, right, Tracy?
Sure. You can tweet us at hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio, and we can answer your questions that way as well. We're talking about suicide with Dr. Maren Veldick, and I don't know if we've talked specifically about some breakout groups here, but teenagers, are they especially at risk, or how do teenagers fit into the puzzle of suicide?
Purely in numbers, they're a little bit below the general overall risk, but still very high. I think they're the group that is most prone to influence from the outside world, such as media or hearing about suicide with their friends or within the communities. And then the impact on the families and the number of years of life that are lost.
Sure.
So I think in that way, it's one of the most tragic suicides.
You said people who are impulsive, mm-hmm. and teenagers certainly mm-hmm. would be considered mm-hmm. to be more impulsive mm-hmm. than mm-hmm. as they get older. So that must play a role as well.
That plays a very big role.
Okay.
Myth or matter of fact, men are at greater risk for suicide.
That is correct. That is the truth.
Women attempt suicide more often than men.
That is also true.
But men are complete it, because I remember this unfortunately from last time, men will more often use a weapon, will use a gun in this country than a woman would. And that is why men are usually more, unfortunately, successful with the suicide attempt.
Yes, that is true for our country here. Mm-hmm. In some countries where there are similar ways of attempting suicide, such as a pesticide ingestion, then the differences are smaller.
In what countries would that be?
That would be India and in China. And for some reason, South Korea has almost equal rate of suicides with the men and women. Yes.
Wow. Interesting.
What about military? If we broke out for the teenagers, I know over the past few years, if soldiers have returned from Iraq and Afghanistan, the rate for ex-military or former soldiers has skyrocketed.
Yes, this is something that we observed before this wars against terrorists. The rates in of suicide in the army was lower than the general population, and now it's higher than in the general population. And we don't know exactly what is the reason. There's extensive research going on to try to understand better, but at least there is a role for a post-traumatic stress disorder.
We talked about what to do if you notice that someone else is depressed or whatever. But let's talk about for yourself. If you mm-hmm. are a soldier or a teenager or just anyone mm-hmm. that is starting to feel like or have thoughts of suicide, what should you do? Because if you're starting to feel suicidal, you don't want to go and get help for yourself.
Yes. Ask for help. And the main thing that needs to happen is a change of a culture when being depressed or having suicidal thoughts is viewed as a weakness. That is the same thing like having any other medical condition where we just, let's say we have a pain or we have a stomachache, we we don't think of this being a shame or asking for a help. Mm-hmm. And once we will be able to have the same approach with the sadness, with the suicidal thoughts, with depression, where for people will be normal to go and see their doctors, sure, to talk to their family, to ask for a help without thinking of this as being something different from any asking help for anything else. That would be the biggest thing for decreasing suicide rate.
Not an easy topic to talk about suicide, but we invite your comments and questions. Our telephone number, 507-282-1234.
I was just going to say, one of the criticisms last month when Robin Williams died of the media coverage was that there was some people who would say he has struggled with mental problems his whole life. I don't know if he had bipolar or whatever his diagnosis was. But there was quite a few people who would say his struggle is now done. His pain is now past. And there was some criticism of putting possibly a positive spin on, well, now he doesn't suffer anymore. What did you think when you would see that in the media? What did you think about that message?
When you are suffering through a depression, it may look like that from your own skin. And that's why there's a need of community and also medical profession to step in and help those people to be able to explain them and guide them through the end of this tunnel because there is an end, but you often don't. It's impossible to see it from your own skin when you are depressed. But yes,
507-282-1234. John has a question for you, Dr. Valdik. Good morning, John. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I was wondering. I think a lot of people, you know, that are on low incomes and stuff like that, don't know where to go get help. And they figure a psychiatrist is going to cost a lot of money, and I feel they shouldn't even go in because
they're sort of trapped. I understand exactly what you're saying, right, Dr. Valdik? But you are not the only place where someone can go. I mean, there are lots of services out there. Tell us about those.
Yes, and mental health has really changed in recent years and in a way how treatments are funded, and there is really no reason for any person in the United States not to be able to receive psychiatric care or help with the suicide. It may be in a different way than for some people just checking in to their doctor if they have a stable situation. But there is a way. If somebody is completely at loss and they don't know what to do, if they are in a crisis, the best way to start would be through just going to the emergency department. But there are also a number of organizations that are able to help people. One of the organizations is American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. Another organization is National Alliance on Mental Illness. There is also a number of suicide prevention lifelines. Factors should not limit people from receiving help when it comes to suicide.
And we have the same information right in front of us. So let's say it's suicidepreventionlifeline.org. You can go there.
Yes.
You can call them at 1-800-273-TALK. Or even if it's to a point, you could call 911.
Absolutely.
Yep, lots of resources out there that are most of them without charge, right?
Yes, that is correct.
You know, I was looking through the list of risk factors, and obviously the one that you have emphasized is depression as a risk factor for suicide. But the other one that I found interesting that I was unaware of is that if you're bisexual, you're gay, or you're transgender, and you have an unsupportive family, those people are at increased risk for suicide.
Very much true. And this is especially a vulnerable population during their adolescent years, where they are surrounded by peers who really don't understand what it's going on. And people themselves at that point, sure, still don't understand often what is going on, and they can often be victims of bullying and unsupportive families. And yes, they are one of the most vulnerable populations.
I would say if you put just took away any of the stuff before that and just put unsupportive family, if you're having a trouble of whatever, if it's financial or if it's chemical or whatever it might be, not having that network of support would be troubling.
It is troubling.
507-282-1234. Beth is on the line to talk about a specific question for survivors. You mean cancer survivors, Beth?
Well, my husband took his life in 1974. He did not choose to seek good emotional help. I did. And I can hear the words of the wonderful psychiatrist now. Beth, don't blame yourself. You never know unless it actually happens, and it may not happen. But let me share with you, and would the dear doctor please elaborate on the importance of those that are survivors, those whose loved ones have made that choice, the importance of them to invest in good mental health.
And Beth is reading my show notes because that's what we wanted to talk about next. What do you do when you have lost someone to suicide?
Yeah, suicide, grief, how to cope. And Beth, are you still there? Oh,
sorry. She's gone.
Oh, okay. So her husband committed suicide. How many years ago is that?
In the 40? 70s, yes. Yeah, almost 40.
Long time ago. And she obviously has coped with it. And how do you do it? And how do people like that get help?
Yeah. So there are several ways how to do it. And the organizations that we talked about just the moments before, like American Foundation for Suicide Prevention or NAMI, they would keep track of if there is a support groups in the local community, and they can connect surviving members of the families with those groups. Another is if person has a religious beliefs to through their communities too, or if they are developing themselves a depression or sadness, they can also seek counseling and help from a medical profession. So I would just like to emphasize that there is many ways, and that's important thing to do to be able to deal with this in a way that will then leave a good memories of our tragically passed away.
You had mentioned that one of the things you studied, the genetic impact, the genetic link in, you know, is there a, I don't know, would you say, a mental health gene? If you are a child of someone who committed suicide, that would be something that then you'd probably want to watch, just like if it was alcoholism or something like that ran in the family, quote unquote. That would be something to watch that child as they grow up, right? Wouldn't that be something to consider?
That would be something to consider, because there may be a high risk for that person to attempt suicide. In general, if they would develop a depression, then we would really need to be watchful about asking about those thoughts. And that's a part of the regular visit with the psychiatrist, that they should at each appointment ask about the suicidal thoughts, and then approach a situation as it is appropriate.
Myth or matter of fact, suicides peak during the holidays.
Yeah, that is one of the myths. It looks logical to many people, but when they really did the numbers and calculated, the studies showed mostly spring, summertime.
That doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, it doesn't.
Spring and summer. You'd think in the dark winter days, maybe it's the southern hemisphere more than the northern. I don't know. How much, where does the future lie for this? When you were talking about research and the genetic component of some of this, what are you researching?
So I think the future is two important things for the future and how to decrease the suicide. And one is to be that this is something that people are not ashamed of, depression, suicidal thoughts, that there is no stigma attached to it, so they can easily access and their medical providers, they can talk to their family members like they would talk about anything else. When it comes to the lab research is identifying both genes that are associated with the suicide, but probably even more importantly, what we call epigenetic reasons. And these are the other molecular events in our brains that change how the genes operate in our body. And there are a number of studies that are looking into that direction. And that's how we can limit the impact of the environment.
Hopefully that will be successful, because I'm sure it would help a lot of people and help solve this very difficult problem. You did mention earlier that one of the prevention measures that is important for suicide is educating family physicians to recognize depression and refer those patients on or treat the depression, right?
Yeah, I would even call it the single most important measure that we are aware of at this time, because this is the most common point of where people where they communicate with the medical profession is through their family care provider.
Frontline. Yeah. Sure.
That's the right word. And and when they did studies, the increased awareness of primary care providers about depression and suicide really did decrease the rate of suicide. That's how we need to do it at this point.
And the other thing I heard you mention is that if someone, one of your family members, you think may be suicidal, obviously get them help, but get rid of the, at least temporarily, the firearms and the pills.
Yes. So this is one of the most common recommendations that I give to my patients who have suicidal thoughts or who are at increased risk for suicides. If they are hunters, if they have guns,
sure.
We ask them, well, why don't you just give this temporarily to your friends? Or there is many ways how the weapons can be stored until this thoughts go away, and also to limit the access to dangerous pills.
All right. Review for us again, because we're almost out of time. The warning signs of an individual who could be suicidal. What do you watch for? What do you look for? And what questions should the family physician ask?
Well, family physician should ask about sadness, about depressed mood, about other signs of depression. If person is isolating themselves, if their energy for life is going down for no obvious medical reason. Sleep disturbance is another strong risk factor.
And if I think someone is suicidal, if I'm concerned, I should just ask them straight out, are you thinking of suicide?
Yes, that would be a good and simple way to do it.
Wow. Thanks so much for all your help. And don't forget the suicide hotline, 1-800-273-TALK. Dr. Maren Veldick, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me here.
You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Coming up, we'll tell you about next week's program. Stay with us.
Welcome back. Next week on Mayo Clinic Radio, we'll talk with the chairman of the Department of Cardiovascular Diseases. That's your heart and your blood vessels. That's the Mayo Clinic.
He
is the chairman, right. Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Dr. Chet Rehal. Well, you know this. Some people still don't, unfortunately. Heart disease kills more men and women than anything else. Far and away, much more common cause of death than breast cancer in women. In fact, it kills more women than men.
And the trouble is that the symptoms are different for women than for men.
That's right. Women are different than men.
Oh.
We've learned that too. And you know, most of the deaths are related to coronary artery disease. That is the arteries that supply blood to your heart. And if they get plugged up, it's bad news. We'll tell you what the symptoms are. We'll tell you how they make the diagnosis. And if one of those arteries clogs up, what you need to do, call 911, and what else you need to do on the way to the hospital. Plus, we'll talk to you about prevention. There are just a few lifestyle changes that you can make that will significantly reduce your risk of heart disease. Heart disease next week on Mayo Clinic Radio with the chairman.
We hope you'll join us. For more information on topics discussed on this program, please visit our website, radio.mayoclinic.org, where you can access a podcast of today's program, as well as previous episodes, or visit us at mayoclinic.org. There's over 3,000 physicians, scientists, and researchers from Mayo Clinic there who will share their expertise to empower you to manage manage your health.
You've been listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Our senior producer is Ron Petrovich. Our associate producer and phone screener is Chris Ryan, with assistance from Joel Streed.
Oh, Joel's here.
Our technical director, Rich Peterson. Our theme music was written and performed by Chip Davis of Mannheim Steamroller. For Mayo Clinic Radio, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Thanks for being with us.
Any medical information conveyed during this program is not intended as a substitute for personal medical advice, and you should not take any action before consulting a healthcare professional. For more information, please go to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org. Please join us each week on this station for more of the medical information you want from Mayo Clinic specialists who know.